Audi.
Hello and welcome to the Big Travel Podcast. I'm Lisa Francesca Nand. Chris Helenga was only 22 when, after spending a few months in China, was diagnosed with incurable breast cancer. Instead of her plans to travel the world, she threw herself into building Copperfeel, her wonderful charity. Passion can take you to some incredible places, she says, and her message has indeed taken her to some wonderful places, both literal and metaphorical. She recently celebrated her 10-year cancerversary in true Chris Helenga style and has some important words for us about enjoying travel, enjoying life, and enjoying every moment. Recorded in the offices of Copperfeel in London, it's the inspirational Chris Helenga.
I don't know if we start from you just coming back from Disney. Yeah, wait, let's do it. Why have you been in Disney?
I love Disneyland and I haven't been since I was 8 years old. And I always wanted to go back and see if it was just as magical when you're an adult. And actually it is.
Which one were you at? Florida?
No, Paris.
Paris. I love Paris.
I don't think I could handle Florida. I think it would just be too overwhelming. And we wanted to make sure that we could do all the rides. And the good thing, well, you know, one of the perks of having stage 4 cancer is that you get a blue badge and therefore you get to skip all the queues. So, yeah, so we got to go on all the rides and experience all the magic that is Disney. It was brilliant fun.
I worked there, actually. I worked in Paris for about 3 months and it was in the backstage area, which is like in a weird industrial estate.
Oh, God.
But with, like, you know, Mickey popping through and Snow White and dwarves and reindeer because it was Christmas. And you saw, like, Pluto with his head off having a fag and, you know, sort of Mickey having half a bottle of wine at lunchtime.
That would just, like, absolutely destroy the magic.
It's a good job I wasn't with you. It, to me, it seems that going to Disney with a bunch of your mates kind of really, you know, you just seem so vibrant and full of life and full of fun. And you are, but you are also living with a very serious disease. I mean, how much of that energy is there, or do you really have to draw on it?
I think it's mostly there. When I'm well, I really try to make the most of that. And I don't really have to work too hard on drawing up some energy. It's more like if I'm not well, then obviously I take time out and I rest and I try and recuperate and get better as quickly as I can. And then the rest of the time, it's very natural to me to just, like, do everything and just experience everything.
Where are you with the cancer? I saw on Twitter that you had some tumours that had shrunk the other day, which is obviously a good thing.
Yeah, so it's an ongoing thing, and it's a case of finding the right treatments at the right time. But most recently, because the cancer had progressed quite a lot at the end of last year, and so I changed treatment in December, and then recently I found out that the treatment was working quite well. And actually, I've felt much better than I have in a long time, even though I'm on a much more toxic treatment regime now. So I seem to be responding quite well, and I feel good. And it means that I get 3 months off thinking about stuff, thinking about scan results and stuff. So they scan me again in 3 months' time.
Does it get to you?
When things are bad, yeah, absolutely. It's not. I think people think that I'm quite a positive Polly a lot of the time, but they don't see me on the down days. I try to, you know, represent myself as in the most authentic way, I guess, online, and demonstrate that it's not always a bed of roses. But actually, a lot of the time, it is fine, and I am doing well. And when I'm low, I have a lot of, because I've had it for 10 years, I have a lot of coping strategies now. I've kind of built up a bit of a toolbox of how I can deal with things. And I've kind of become the boss of my own health and ensuring that I understand my cancer really well and can almost guess its next move and preempt whatever might happen next. So when I get scan results, I know that if my doctor tells me something bad that the cancer's progressed, I know that what I'm going to do next. I already know the next step. And that's a very much a learned thing that I've had to adapt to and get my head around. And it's taken 10 years to do that.
So. And you recently did celebrate, if that's the right word, your 10-year cancer anniversary. And you did it with the most beautiful little video online, and also your 10 tips for making every day great, which I will go through those at the end because they're wonderful. But I want to start with the travel, because travel, I think, is something that's always been in your blood and it seems to be very dear to your heart. Mm-hmm. You studied travel and tourism and wanted to go into that and did go into that briefly. Yeah. But you seem to have managed to have achieved those dreams that you had, even though you went down an unexpected path.
Yeah.
And so where should we start? You were born in Germany, actually. Yeah. That's a place of travel.
I was born in right up north on the coast. A lot of people don't realise that there's a beautiful coast in Germany and there's beautiful islands, but no one tends to go there. It's only a few German holidaymakers that tend to go there. So, yeah, I was born there and had a German dad, and my mum's British. And then we moved to England when I was 10.
And there's these great stories about you being completely German and you and your twin sister being in the playground and just talking to each other in German and being sort of ostracised by the local children.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, maybe not so great, but it sounded quite amusing when you told it.
Well, the thing is, we had each other, so it was fine. It would have been far scarier if we'd been on our own. But yeah, we refused to speak English to each other because it sounded so weird to us. Our accent was terrible. And so in the playground, we would just be speaking German, obviously, completely excluding ourselves from everyone until a girl called Faye befriended us, and then things got better.
You sound like completely English now, though. Can you still slip back into your German accent?
When I'm there, I mean, I understand it all, and I can speak it fairly well. I can get by. Yeah, no, I don't think the accent is really ever there, but when I'm there, I can put on a pretty good German spiel.
So you wanted to travel, you know, you wanted to work in travel, and you have, you know, ended up traveling extensively. But you were on your first assignment in travel and tourism. Was it internship in Beijing?
Yeah.
When you first started to notice that you were really sick with the, you know, the symptoms of the cancer.
Yeah. It was just before I left that I wasn't actually in Barcelona with my mum and my sister. And that's when I first mentioned the lumps in my left breast to them, and they said we should maybe get it checked out. And I went to the GP just before I was leaving for Beijing, and I really didn't want her to say that I needed to stay and have tests and delay my trip. And thankfully she didn't. She said it was fine and that was nothing to worry about. So I got to go and had an amazing time in China. It was a great experience because I was 22 and I really didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. But I got to study Mandarin, and so I'd go to school in the morning and then go to work for a Chinese French travel company, which was very weird. Didn't really enjoy it that much, but I enjoyed every other aspect of living there and experiencing the culture and the life of crazy Beijing.
What was the craziest thing that happened in Beijing?
I mean, there were many nights out, very many nights out. I think just being in such a very foreign country, but making friends with all the expats and just living a life, because, you know, I was renting an apartment and I had roommates, and I suddenly had to become very adult very quickly. I think that's when I had to be the most independent I'd ever been, because I didn't go to university. So I didn't have that time away from home where I had to fend for myself. So that was really the first time that I had to do that on my own, because any travel that I'd done previously was with my twin sister. So we always had each other. So I was on my own and really just had to learn to cook myself meals and go to work on time. And in a country like that, it wasn't easy. It really wasn't easy, because I learnt the basics of how to speak to a taxi driver, but I wasn't a local. I really wasn't a local.
So. You must just really stand out.
Yeah, I mean, look at you. I really did stand out. And every morning when we got the subway to work, I was the only white female on the train, surrounded by lots of Chinese businessmen going to work. And I just felt like, wow, I really feel like very alien right now. But it was an amazing experience. I'm not sure if I would do it now, but I had the patience, and just the thrill of it was great when I was that age.
When you're 22, you have that thrill and sense of excitement and sense that you can do anything. And I think that's a wonderful time to travel. And I guess you probably had more ambitions at that point to carry on traveling.
Yeah.
But of course, that's when you became ill and flew back to England. Did you come back early?
So I came back for Christmas. The visa situation was really tough that year because it was the Olympics. So they only give you visas for 3 months. So I had to come home, and I thought I'd go to the GP and get this lump looked at again, and I saw a different GP and he said it was still fine, but I knew it wasn't. And my mum definitely knew it wasn't. And I went back and asked for a referral. And that's when I was very much grounded. I was grounded in the UK. I've thought I was heading back to China or somewhere to teach English. That's the idea of teaching English wherever in the world, because you could go anywhere and teach English. And so I thought, I'm not going to be staying in England long. I'm here for Christmas to see my family and then I'm off again. But that, you know, that changed immediately as soon as I was diagnosed with breast cancer.
I don't want to keep banging on about the breast cancer, but it is sort of really integral to the whole sort of travel experience.
Yeah,
I mean,
it really is.
How did that make you feel?
I mean, it's hard to describe, but I was just more shocked and confused more than anything, because all the way along, I'd been treated with this sort of attitude of, you're too young, so this isn't going to be anything bad. And that it flipped on 180 degrees on the day that I was told it was something really bad. And I was just so baffled by that. And obviously, at the time, I didn't really know anything about cancer, only really bad stuff. It's only stuff that I'd really sort of seen in the media, and I just assumed that it was just going to be the end. And then it was within a week that I was told that it was stage four, so it was already incurable. And that's when things, I guess, stepped up a gear, and I knew that I had to really try very hard to get better. And I was not going to be heading off anywhere anytime soon. But it was later in the year, so I was diagnosed in February 2009. And by December 2009, my sister and I went to San Francisco to see friends. And I thought, that's amazing. Like, after all of this, I packed my backpack, as in my, like, backpacking backpack. And even though a suitcase would have been much more handy.
Yeah, for San Francisco, definitely.
Yeah, I just thought, no, I want to feel like a traveler again. And I want to feel like I'm getting to explore a whole new world that is so far removed from cancer. And I got to do that. It was amazing.
You went to Australia before, didn't you? So was that before, that was before Beijing, wasn't
it?
Yeah,
that was when I was 18. My sister and I always knew that we weren't going to go straight to university, that we would always take a gap year and go travel around Australia, because our mum had done it. So our mum was a real travel bug as well when she was younger, and that definitely rubbed off on us. She took us to all sorts of places when we were younger. So we knew that was the plan. Australia was the plan. So we worked in apple packing factories and bought a van and travelled around. And that was the best 9 months ever.
Was that before or after the Wolf Creek days? Did you ever see that? It's the scariest horror film ever and I can't watch it again. And it just made me when I went to Australia, it really made me put me off, like, going around in the backpack.
I think that was probably after.
In the outback with a van. It's the horriblest film ever.
Yeah.
It was really realistic as well.
Yeah, there were some hairy moments, but on the whole.
What stands out from that time?
I think, what stands out is going to the outback, which went on the longest bus journey ever to get to Ayers Rock and Alice Springs. But we met some really great people on the bus. But, you know, when you're that age, you just think, no, I'm going to suck it up. But now I would not endure, like, however long bus ride it was, like maybe 12 hours. But then you're just like, no, it's the cheapest thing to do, so that's what I'm going to do. And you just kind of suck it up, and you end up actually having the best time and meeting the best people. And we slept out near Ayers Rock, and it was actually really great. But I loved everything about Australia. Again, it was the first time being independent with my sister and going away and making meals for ourselves and just having to really grow up. And I mean, buying a van when you're 18 is like quite scary, but we did it, and it was just a real laugh. It was really good. Really good. And I think the only thing that I would have done differently is that I had a boyfriend at home. So I didn't, you know, it's not like my sister and I went crazy and met loads of guys, because we both had boyfriends at home. And I think, don't go travelling when you're 18 with a boyfriend at home.
No. And maybe do go travelling, but ditch the boyfriend.
Yeah.
I think that is, you know, speaking as a woman, that has been the thing that stopped me from doing a lot of things. Well, not stopped me necessarily, but stopped me from fully enjoying them as much, because you're sort of pining for someone back home.
Yeah, and you're always having to spend a lot of money on telephone cards. I mean, it's different now with, I don't know, WhatsApp and stuff. But back then it was telephone cards and spending a lot of time in phone booths and stuff. And I could have been doing other things.
Yeah, especially as you're not with him now. You know,
yeah,
it's like,
exactly.
What was the point?
I know, it was like the first love. I mean, I have no regrets, but I definitely would recommend for like for people to ditch the boyfriends.
Yeah. Do you know what? I look back on a lot of my travels and think exactly the same thing. I do. I mean, but at the time you're in love and, you know, it's really intense. And...
Yeah. And he was really supportive. He's not like he was saying, I'll come back early or anything like that. And he was happy for me, but.
Yeah. It does change the experience. Yeah. But when you look back, you remember the positive stuff anyway. You know? Also, what you said about not having phones is really interesting. Mm. I was thinking about this the other day, the amount, you know, I would disappear for weeks abroad without my parents really speaking to me and contacting me, and you know, maybe like a phone call once a week or something like that. I'd have no idea where you were. You'd have no idea where you were. You wouldn't have a map, or you know, just a paper map.
Yeah,
we've become so much more dependent on being in touch and technology.
Yeah, I mean, even on the way over to Australia, we went via Malaysia and onto this island called Langkawi.
Oh, I've been there. It's amazing.
Oh, isn't it great? Yeah. And we were so excited, a bit too overexcited. We met these guys who'd been stationed there from the army, and they were having a few nights off, and we decided very drunkenly to get piggybacks from them to get back through this water section back to a hotel, when we could have walked the long way around, but we decided to cut a corner, piggyback through water, rocky water. The guy that I was on the back of ended up tripping over, and I had everything in my bag: my phone, my camera, my passport, my money. Thankfully, we had Australian dollars, which were waterproof, which was fine. Everything got ruined, and it was the very start of our trip, and I was absolutely gutted. And plus, I've still got a scar on my foot from where I scratched this massive rock. But then we got to Australia, and we had to buy these new phones, and we had old school film cameras back then. Like, it was just all ruined, and I just thought, this will teach us a lesson very quickly to be more careful. But also, just having to go into a shop and get a phone that was so crappy, and they could do the bare minimum, text to the family to let you know that you're okay. And I think nowadays, when you can FaceTime people and WhatsApp people 24/7 and share stuff on social media, I just think that person who's gone away feels much closer.
Yeah.
And you'll feel much closer to home as well. And I'm not sure it's the same experience now.
It's not the same experience. There's positive things about it. Yeah. Like, my brother lives in LA, and we FaceTime each other sometimes every night. Yeah. And it feels like we haven't, you know, we don't really lose touch. For the first few years he was there, we'd speak to each other once every 4 months, you know, and it felt like we did lose touch, but then it felt really intense and fabulous when you spoke to each other again.
Yeah, I think that's nicer. I do really think that's nicer, because then you've got more to talk about. And I think if had I been able to contact home so much, I would have been bogged down with so much stuff that was happening at home and not really experiencing what I was experiencing.
Skyping a boyfriend every night.
Yeah, just like, no. No, that would have just been such a bore.
So when you got back from Beijing and, you know, you had the cancer diagnosis, you set up the charity. Yeah. And there was a really wonderful story about you being in Downing Street when you actually got the go-ahead to open the charity. What's the word?
To get charity status. Yeah, we would have got charity status anyway, but it was the usefulness of speaking to someone at 10 Downing Street while it was Sarah Brown at the time, and asking her whether she could just chase up the charity commission and see if we were going to get status. And then I got the call the next day from 10 Downing Street saying that they were looking into it and that things were looking good. I mean, that was just, I think that's still the most rock and roll story that I've got.
Well, you do have a lot of rock and roll stories, because you've got a lot of celebrity supporters and you seem to have been able to really harness their power for the charity. And, you know, the charity is doing so well. You've saved women's lives, you know, you literally saved women's lives, which is incredible. How have you managed to do that, you know, to get these really influential people on board?
I think being in the right place at the right time. I was lucky enough to win awards or go to events and stuff where these people hang out, and I just start talking to them. And I think you just have to be quite bold. And I always believed in myself and what I was trying to achieve. So I thought, surely they're not going to be annoyed by me telling them what I'm trying to do. And actually no one ever was. And then the ones that cared stuck with me, and the ones that weren't so fast didn't. And that's fine. And these days celebrities have so many charities that they support, and a lot of them are already taken up and are doing their own thing. And that's absolutely fine. But when you can find someone who really understands what you're trying to achieve and really gets it, that's the best thing. And people like Fern Cotton are certainly one of them. And just whatever they can do, in whatever time they've got, they will do. And I think to this day, I don't think people like Fern really understand the impact that they can have. After being on her podcast a few months ago, we had so many messages of people saying, I've been to the doctor, I've found something, and it's either fine or they've been diagnosed and with breast cancer early. And yeah, she doesn't realise how incredible her impact is and in using her platform for good. Oh, she does, but I don't think she really realises how incredible that is. And I think a few other celebrities don't really understand that either. But it's amazing when we hear some really positive stories off the back of their support. It's a great feeling.
Because your aim is to get people to check themselves so they will get that diagnosis early, because yours was late, you know, through no fault of your own. For a start, you didn't know about checking because you don't when you're 21 and 22. You just don't. You know, you don't even think about it.
Yeah.
When you did go to your GP, they totally dismissed you, again, for the same reasons, because you're so young. I mean, it is rare to get it young, but it happens.
Yeah, it happens. And I guess, you know, what we're trying to do is instill a habit. We're not saying that you're going to get it in your 20s, but it could happen. But the chances of you getting it when you're older are incredibly high and increases with age. And you just think, well, if you're 50 and you've been checking since you were 20, you will know your boobs so well. And you would notice if something's changed.
So after you founded the charity and the charity, you know, started to do well, you started to do treks and things for the charity. And a wonderful one that sounded incredible through Iceland.
Yeah, it was amazing. I'd been to Iceland before, so I knew the magic of it. And I thought actually experiencing it on a hike would be incredible because you get to see all the terrain and just really feel like you're part of that incredible nature. And it was, I think, a 3-day trek, and it was, every day was so vastly different, and it was amazing. The colours and just everything about it was brilliant. And just doing it with a good bunch of people who had all raised, I mean, we raised thousands and thousands of pounds for Cobfield. And they all had their stories and all had their own reason for being there. And that's the magic of those treks. And I think that's why they've been so successful. When the people come back from the trek, they have these incredible bonds with everyone that they've been on the trek with. Because I think you just bond over really tough times and blisters and all sorts. And you're there for each other. And you're experiencing something with someone that no one else has. And gosh, some of the friendships that have been created from these hikes is just amazing. I just watch them sometimes at our events. I'm like, oh, wow, we made that happen. Like, they found each other in life because of us. Yeah, and we've got one coming up in the Himalayas this year.
I was really tempted to apply for it. In fact, I looked yesterday thinking, oh, are there any more spaces? And it's gone. The deadline is gone. I was very tempted.
But we might open up. Obviously, we've had so many applications for that one.
Which is incredible, isn't it? That's really good, because it's not an easy, you know, I was reading the itinerary, it wasn't an easy trek necessarily.
It's not. It's probably the toughest one that we've done and the biggest one. So we've got 100 people going this year, which is a lot, but it's our 10th anniversary and we wanted it to be a tougher challenge, a bigger challenge, and really make a big thing of it. So I'm excited for everyone going. I probably won't be heading there, but I kind of live it vicariously through everyone that goes, and someone from the team will be going. And
have you done other ones? I know you did the Iceland.
Yeah, no, that's the only one I've done.
What was the most exhilarating moment about the Iceland trek?
Probably the end. I was very happy to finish. I was very tired at the time. I was taking some drugs for my cancer that just made me feel quite tired, and it were giving me awful mouth ulcers. So when you're obviously hiking, you're not really looking after yourself in the best way possible. And sleeping was really tough and all the rest of it. So I think I was just quite glad to finish and just have that huge sense of achievement of like, okay, I can do anything right now. That was really great.
What was the best view you saw on that journey?
It was just like feeling like you're on the moon. You're walking on this like black sand and you feel like you're on the moon. And then every now and again, there'll be these incredible plants everywhere. And you just think, how are you growing here? It was all pretty amazing. And then on the last day, everyone got to go to the Blue Lagoon, which is obviously the most touristy thing that you could do there. And I wouldn't actually recommend it because there's some actual really nice natural places to go for a dip. And so my sister and some friends came over after we finished the trek. And actually we stayed a few more days in Iceland and I got to explore the northwest part of the island. And it was amazing. We just drove around and just experienced even more of the incredible landscape. And we came across this really cute little waffle house one day. You know, when you just stumble across the most perfect places and it just did the most incredible waffles and cups of tea. And it was just amazing. And it all just worked out so well. And we were driving around in this like Hummer, which made us feel really badass. Yeah, I'd love to go back and explore more of it, really. There's so much land there that hasn't really been seen.
It sounds like travel is very important to you. Mm. Do you have the energy? I mean, obviously you have to conserve your energy, you know, considerably. Do you have the energy to go on lots of things? I mean, a trek through Iceland and a trek through Himalayas is obviously quite challenging.
Yeah.
But, you know, do you ever just go to the Maldives and like slob out on a beach?
I have never been to the Maldives.
You need to go, good for you.
Yeah, I definitely do have very chilled trips too. Because I live in Cornwall, in Newquay. I mean, I live by the beach, so I love being by the ocean. But Newquay Airport flies to some great places like Faro in Portugal. So my sister and I went there a couple of years ago and we just literally just spent a few days by the sea and hired a bike one day. And yeah, it was very nice and just so easy to fly from somewhere so close and then head, you know, be home again so quickly.
It's a great little airport. I've flown from there. Yeah. Do they still charge you a fiver on the way out?
No, they don't.
I always get really annoyed when airports do that. Yeah. I don't know why.
Yeah, no.
Because you're not expecting it. You're like, what do you mean I've got to give you a fiver?
Exactly, like, you don't even know where it's going either. No, they didn't.
Sure, they were using it for some good, you know, yeah, not just for like their beer fund or whatever.
But when we flew to Faro, it was the first time that Newquay Airport was flying there, and they seemed so excited by this, and they were handing out little glasses of port to everyone on the way. So that was really cute.
That sounds great.
Little airport.
Yeah, me too. I do. Some of the smallest airports have been around the world, like Koh Samui. Have you ever been to that one in Thailand? It's really nice. It's just got thatched roofs and you get a little sort of fresh pineapple juice and just sit there on the grass and wait for your plane to come in.
Yeah.
Where else have you been then? Where else have I missed?
I've been to the Philippines.
Were you just on holiday?
Yes. Yeah. I was, well, back in the day, I went out with a guy who was half Filipino. So his mum practically owned one of the tiny islands over there.
Nice.
And so we got to just live island life for a few days and eat fresh fish and incredible mangoes and just, yeah, live on this luxury. Well, it wasn't luxury because there was lots of local people there who didn't have anything that we had, but they seemed far happier than we were. But it was just beautiful. It just felt like you were in luxury because of the beautiful colour of the water and going snorkeling. And it was just amazing. I'd love to go back to the Philippines, but it's a bit crap when you don't have a contact there anymore. Like,
can you not go to your ex-boyfriend and go well, to the man and say, you own an island?
Well, they would actually let me, but it's a bit awkward. It's a bit weird, isn't it? Exes with benefits.
Yeah, exactly. I was told by a clairvoyant I should go to the Philippines. I've never been, actually. A clairvoyant once told me, not that I necessarily believe this stuff, but someone once said to me, you should go to the Philippines. You'll feel at home there. I was like, all right, that's a bit weird. And I still haven't been. I'm a bit scared just in case I do feel at home and like stay forever.
Philippines is great. So I would recommend you. Before I decided to do the HND in travel and tourism and after Australia, I still wasn't ready for university. I wasn't ready to study anything. I just wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. And so I saw this ad for volunteering in Borneo at an orangutan conservation place. And I just called them up and I just inquired. And he said, well, it's really early days still. We've got a special offer where you can go. We basically cover the flight and you just have to pay for the accommodation. And so it was super cheap and it all sounded so perfect. And I was 19 at the time and I thought, this is great. I'm going to get to meet all these new people and stay at this incredible place. And I got there and it was just me and another girl. And the guy dropped us off in the jungle and said, I'll be back in, well, I think we were there for a month. And we were staying literally in the rainforest at this conservation place. And we got to feed the orangutans in the morning and some of the other animals as well. And then for the rest of the day, we just have to entertain ourselves. So there was nothing there. We had a radio and that was it. But we bonded so much.
Guess you had no choice, really.
It was great that she was an amazing human and such fun to hang out with for that time. But it was so far away from our expectations of what we thought it was going to be. We thought there'd be so many more people that it's just us two. And we weren't really sure if they needed us there or not. And I'm quite skeptical of these volunteering holidays where you actually aren't really helping, you're hindering a lot of the time. But it was an amazing experience and the orangutans there, we became really good friends with. They're just like humans too. So it was great to do at the age of 19.
But you were kind of expecting like a bit more of a party.
I just thought I'd just get to meet more people and expand my experience of this, like knowing more people around the world. But it was just me and this girl called Louise from Egham. And it's a great name. Really
was she
great.
From Egham as well?
Yeah, she was from Egham.
Travel is obviously important to you. What do you think, you know, you do have a supposedly terminal illness, even though you've lasted 10 years and you're looking great and fabulous. Mm. What do you think should inspire other people to travel? Do you think travel is good for you?
I think it's the best thing you could do. Going away and experiencing something new is so important. But also at the same time, I love being at home, especially because I live in Cornwall, which is beautiful. I love being at home and there's nothing wrong with staying home. But I think a lot of time people feel like they can't travel because they've been given a bad diagnosis. But I think if you're feeling well, go. And insurance is a big thing. Insurance is a huge issue when it comes to people who've got incurable cancer because, I mean, insurance companies charge a lot of money. I don't get insurance now for that reason. Well, I get normal insurance like covers my luggage or cancel flights, but I can't get insurance for my health because we're talking like £3,000 up. And so I don't do that. And so you have to really consider what's the worst that could happen. And I always think, well, I just get back on a flight and come home immediately. Places like America, I mean, it scares me going to America, given the prices and how much of a bill you could rack up over there.
Just look, you know, thinking of all the treatment that we get here on the NHS and you look over at the States and it's just shocking. My 4-year-old fractured his skull a few weeks ago in two places. Oof. And he was fine, luckily, you know, very luckily. But we spent a week in hospital. We had CAT scans. We had a private room. We had everyone looking after us, round-the-clock care, a drip and everything. Yeah. And that would have cost a couple of hundred grand in the States. And you just think with people that have gone through and are going through what you're going through, you know, it's ruined their lives in so many ways.
Yeah. But I think because we're more aware of our health and we're more aware of what our body needs, it's actually safer than some people who have underlying issues or have accidents away. Like anything can happen to anyone. So I think your cancer diagnosis should never stop you from going abroad and doing what you really want to do. Unless, of course, you're very, very unwell, then you have to really think about the logistics of it all. But on the whole, people who have a terminal diagnosis are well enough to go do these things. And they should.
Have you had any experimental treatment? I know someone that went to a clinic in Arizona or something like that.
I haven't travelled abroad for anything experimental or alternative, no.
I guess you haven't needed to, really.
I'm open to things. I'm open to, I mean, when it comes to this, you try everything, really. But I'm quite sensible and I do my research. But I know a lot of people who travel to places in Germany for treatments, and I knew someone who spent a lot of time at a clinic in Istanbul and actually loved experiencing Turkey while she was there and really lapping up the culture and lapping up the food, and but at the same time obviously having to be in that hospital a lot of the time. So yeah, health tourism is I think getting bigger.
It is indeed. I know people that have done it for like fertility treatments and things like that as well. Yeah. You've had your recent 10-year cancerversary and you released this wonderful video online with your top tips for making every day great. And some of them, they just really spoke to me, and there's things that I really try and do. And I think a lot of us really try and do when you're feeling like sort of January and February a bit rubbish anyway. And like when you're sort of coming out of that sort of whole bit of a fog in winter or for whatever reason. They were exercise even when you don't feel like it. Dream big, dream really big. Don't be intimidated by celebs or other people, which is a really good one. And that might be your boss or anyone that, you know, is sort of perceived to be above you in that way. Take the rough with the smooth. Don't worry about your age because birthdays are meant to be celebrated. And I read an article with you saying more about that, is that people are worried about age and wrinkles. And, you know, these are worries that people should love to have because it means that you're getting older and
you get to be here
you're still alive.
Mm-hmm.
Never underestimate what is possible with a little bit of passion, determination and a projector. And ask yourself, would this be more fun if I was wearing pom-poms, fancy dress or glitter? Absolutely. And 9, dance in big capital letters. And 10, find something you believe in and do it. Are these really this is your philosophy on life?
Yes. Do you know what? This video was made by the team and they've pretty much summed me up very, very well. They know me very well to have come up with that, with those 10 things. And I absolutely try to live by them. It's not always sustainable or doable, but on the whole, they are the things that sum me up. I don't really enjoy exercise, but I do it. And I think because Copperfield has been such a success, it just shows that passion really can take you to some incredible places. Because I knew nothing about running a charity. I knew nothing about business or anything, but I had passion, and that has brought all of this together. So yeah, they're just a couple of things, but I think they are good things to live by. So if people can just do one or two of those things in a week, then I think that's a good thing to do for life.
Dancing especially.
Yeah.
Dancing. Kitchen, I just need to do
it. Kitchen disco dancing.
Even if it's just in the kitchen, yeah. It just makes you, singing and dancing just makes your soul soar. To me anyway, it really does.
Yeah. The other day when we were at Disneyland, we were staying in an Airbnb, and the girls that I was with, we all really like Little Mix. And we just put this song on, and suddenly we were all sort of dancing the same routine. It's like we all, there was no communication between us, but we all started doing the same moves. And then someone filmed it, and it's like, brilliant. Just having that like memory for life is great. I just think, oh, these people are meant to be in my life because we have the best moves.
This is the you've just preempted my last question, because my last question is always about music. And I was going to ask you, if you could think of one song that reminds you of a time or place of travel, a really special or memorable moment, what would that song be?
I think that, I mean, this is going to be so cliche for anyone that went traveling in Australia in the early 2000s, noughties or whatever you call them. It would have to be Jack Johnson, Taylor, because I just remember us driving around in the van and listening to his album, and just everything Jack Johnson just made us feel like we were living the best beach and free and amazing life. So I think that would have to be Jack Johnson Taylor.
I want to go back to Australia and drive around listening to that. Yeah. I really do. In fact, I'm going next year or this at the end of this year. So I might put it on. You're not the first person to choose Jack Johnson.
Really?
Yeah. God. I can't remember if it was relating to Australia. I'll have to listen back.
Yeah. But we were convinced he was Australian, but he's actually from Hawaii.
He's from Hawaii, isn't he? But I think that's the same sort of vibe. It's the same sort of surfy, beachy guitar, sitting around a campfire sort of vibe. Marvellous. Thank you so much. Oh, that's brilliant. Thank you.
Chris, you're doing such wonderful work and have such an inspirational message. It was a pleasure to have you on the podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Next week, join us for ultra runner and adventurer, Jamie Madison.